You are listening to the podcast edition of AFI On Screen, a program of the American Film Institute. Images, upcoming schedule, and additional podcast editions at AFI.com.
Our guest this afternoon has learned probably the most important lesson is in this business early in his film career, a lesson that many experienced executives have never learned, and that is simply that, quote, the first objective is to make a good movie, the second is to have a hit. If you get it backwards, you probably won't get either. Our guest this afternoon has proven that theory true again and again in, for this business, where projects can sometimes be years apart, in remarkably rapid succession. Please welcome John Hughes. Let's start at the beginning, if we can, sort of a three-parter. I'm wondering how and why did you make the change from an ad agency in Chicago to the National Lampoon? Was it a clean, quick break or a slower transition? And what did you find the National Lampoon experience to be in terms of training or learning experience?
It was an odd move, that's for sure. I'd been freelancing while I was writing ad copy. I was a creative director at an agency. And as you move up in an agency, they use you less and less for what you're good at. So I was a good writer, and they moved me into, you know, kept moving me up into administrative things, which I'm not very good at. And I'd been always writing articles and things on the side. So when I moved to the Lampoon, it was something that I was about to turn 29, and I realized that if I didn't move soon, I'd be so deeply entrenched in, you know, corporate business life and, you know, country club memberships and all that sort of stuff that I'd never, it would be very difficult to leave. As it was kind of financially irresponsible. I had a three-year-old son and a pregnant wife and a new house, and, you know, I went off to be an editor for like a salary that was somewhat less than my Christmas bonus, you know. But we had a big snowstorm in Chicago, and I got to stay home for about 10 days and just write. And it was so much fun doing that. I said, I can't go back and, you know, write commercials anymore. So I made the jump. You know, I gave myself 3 years, and I figured that, you know, that I could go back in failure, you know, in defeat. But if I didn't try it, then, you know, I mean, I dreaded like being 75 in a nursing home somewhere, saying, you know, I should have. So I really don't want to ever in my life have to regret something, you know. So I thought I'd take putting myself in a position where I would regret, wouldn't have to regret not trying something. But, you know, I mean, the other things that I could have done, I could have regretted seriously too. But I was working there already. I was doing a lot of freelance work there, and it was a completely free atmosphere. I mean, there was no restrictions at all. I could write anything I wanted, and it was an enormous outlet because a lot of the guys that worked there didn't want to do anything. If you were on staff and you were getting paid anyway, why bother? So I was this freelancer, and I got a nickel for every word I wrote. So I wrote lots of words and made a lot of nickels, and It was just a good outlet, and it was deadline writing, and it was 5 or 6 people putting this magazine together every month, plus separate, you know, additional projects, and so I got to learn how to write in a lot of different areas, making jokes about all different types of things and parodying style. So it was really a good education, while it was, you know, paving the way for the next thing, which was to write for the screen. And when Animal House came out, I was like, okay, well, you know, the studios all rushed after Lampoon writers, and I got a development deal, which turned into a horrible script, which was followed by another pretty bad script, which was followed by another bad script.
Because you moved from the, you moved sort of with the Lampoon into the movies, but as you say, your first experiences, Class Reunion and the Joy of Six, on which you didn't even get screen credit.
I was real happy about that. I didn't know that. No, I mean, it had nothing to do with I mean, my draft was just, I mean, I spent 3 years, I got 23 drafts, I got fired three times. It was like, it became a quest, you know, and I didn't care, I just, you know, make it. And, it was just a terrible grind, but it was also good because it forced me over a three-year period to try to find a way in to this, solving this problem and dealing with the studio and trying to get them to make the movie. And, you know, I mean, 3 years, 23 drafts to get back to exactly where I started, which also taught me something about the pitfalls of the development process. But it was not an entirely bad situation. Actually, my first situation was, which was a parody of the Jaws movies, was a better situation from a learning standpoint because it was one of those things where you just, when you start out, you just want to get something made. You just have to get something made. And there was a great deal of disappointment involved with that. And it really wasn't very good. I mean, it wasn't about, is this a good script? It was more, is this something that they'll make? Which is really the wrong question to ask. But, you know, when I was working in that situation, it was the only question I could conceive of. And then Class Reunion was a great experience because it was really good for me, I think, to go out first thing and just be humiliated into a hole, you know. It was, you know, it started out with what I'd hoped was going to be like, because I'd gone to my class reunion and I'd seen how nobody changed, you know. Like, they had all these separate lives, but they all got back together again, and they were the same people, and they had the same groups, and it turned into this thing. It was on cable the other night, and I was like bopping through the channels, and I was like, God, this is awful. Because I saw it once in a theater when it came out, and I'm leaving the theater, I had the theater owner yelling at me. You know? He was really, because he'd booked it for a month, you know, thinking it was going to be Animal House, and he was real mad. And I'm sorry. And a talk show in Chicago did a guy did a he devoted his he was so mad about this movie and the way it was marketed that he did a whole show on how reprehensible this movie was. So and when the show was over, I called him up at the station. He thought I was going to, you know, go after him. And he said, "Well, look, if it's just my opinion, this is America." You know? And I said, "No, I agree with you entirely. Really is." And he had me on the show the following day to discuss how things can go wrong. And, you know, that type of marketing, which I really, really don't like, you know, where you... I mean, there's a lot of people that actually go out and, like, pay money that they don't really... You know, here you can screen it at your house, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are actually people who pay to see movies and, like, they have to make the purchase decision, that sort of thing. So that was really reprehensible to go out and represent it the way it was. Plus, it was just horrible, and I think every piece of footage was in the final cut. I went to 2 days and got asked to leave because I wasn't laughing at dailies, which I thought was, you're not laughing at dailies, right? Which I also learned a great thing is, which is not to pay attention to the laughs in the dailies. It's a lesson that I was repeated with 16 Candles. All the stuff that got the huge laughs in dailies isn't in the movie. Hmm. It's all the broad, silly stuff that they remember when you were shooting it, you know. Is that for
how did you
not answering your question?
How did you then turn the experience of learning not what to do into what learning what to do with, say, starting with Vacation and Mr. Mom? Those both
well,
clicked.
Mr. Mom was not a development deal.
Right.
And Vacation really wasn't either. There was a short story that I'd written, so I was writing a screenplay based on my short story. And I wrote the script before we set it up. And Mr. Mom was, you know, I mean, getting pretty beaten up around town, not getting things made. I said, well, if they pay me money, start money on a script, then they have the right to, you know, infuse it with their own ideas. And I thought, if they don't have any money invested, then I can go to them with the script and say, here it is, do you like it the way it is? Do you not like it the way it is? If they say yes, well, you can buy it, and we'll deal with the price. Or, you know, if you don't like it, fine, no money down, no obligation, you know? And I found that was a much more satisfying way to work. It's a harder way to work when you start now because you need the money, you know, you need the development money. But from that point on, I didn't do any development deals, because I controlled the script up until the very last minute when it, as soon as I took the check, boom, 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 it was all over. And ultimately lost control of that, which made me then decide, okay, wait a minute, I'm going to direct myself if I can. And, you know, it was that was a real turning point in my career, was when I started writing things that I liked and that I felt like I wanted to do, rather than, you know, going in, pitching an idea, and the studio saying, okay, great, go write a draft, and then getting into it and, you know, I really don't like this or this. And then having to deal with the memos and all that sort of stuff, which is, you know, I mean, I really believe that you know, the script is, it's a one-man thing. You know, I mean, people work in teams. I did two collaborations at the outset of my career, which weren't, I mean, that was, okay, you're going to write with this guy, here he is, hi, how are you, and you meet, and you have lunch, and you talk, and then how do you, I mean, it was a process. Okay, I'll do this scene, you do this scene, I'll do this scene. You go through it and you realize that you've given him all, he's given you all the transition scenes. And, you know, you do exterior establishing shots and I'll do all the dialogue. You know, I mean, I don't know how that works out. And then I had two collaborations, and Joyous Sex was a very odd collaboration because it was with Dan Greenberg, who was a much different kind of writer than I was. He was older than I was. And the main problem was is that my sexual reality was his nightmare. And his sexual reality, my fantasy. So it was like, my stuff was real pedestrian and his was like wonderful, you know. So it was something that was very hard to, for me to work on, because I think it's really a singular thing. And comments are one thing, but when someone forces you to put ideas in, it's another thing, you know. I mean, they can say, well, you know, I read this and it doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, fine, why? Well, because halfway through a character disappears, and, you know. I mean, those sorts of things are welcome. But when they say, okay, what I'd like here is right after here, move this scene over here and put this in, and then add this guy. And I mean, me personally, I lose. You know, I'm sort of like a bird, you know. And the script is the baby, and if somebody touches it too much, and you have to kick it out of the nest, you know, because it gets other people's imprint on it. And I don't see it the same anymore. So, working with spec scripts, I don't have to do that. I can just say, here it is, and I think it's fair. I think it's, you know, it's good, it's regular business, you know. I mean, here's the script, you know, you like it, you're not, and this is the way it's going to be. I mean, a lot of this business is how much can you control the process, and how much will you be controlled? And I found it very difficult to deal with the fact that on a movie set, the writer's the least important person. I mean, walking around a set as the writer, it's like, you know, who's the guy with the pad and pen, you know? And it was very, you know, because it's like, wait a minute, I made up all this stuff, you know? I mean, there's an order to it, and it's, you know, you shoot this and cut it this way, and, you know, and these are my characters. And it was very hard for me to be completely isolated from the process, and from the project, too. I directed, and I think it's time for another question because I'm really rambling.
Oh. But anyway, after Vacation and Mr. Mom, you're hot, so to speak. Was it easy then
But I didn't notice that. I didn't notice that because I was shooting 16 Candles. I was shooting 16 Candles when
you'd
it came out.
You had already gotten the
I had the deal for 16 Candles and Breakfast Club before those two movies came out. And so I didn't really notice it, you know. And I really wasn't, I didn't know what, you know, numbers and figures were. And I didn't realize that I had like these pictures were simultaneously racking up all these dollars and stuff. Because I suspected that they weren't real happy with Mr. Mom. It didn't review real well. I guess it was like a television movie and all stuff. But what they didn't notice was that it was a period in that summer where it was like a real contrast, you know. It's like you got 8 kids laying around the house in August. What do you do with them, you know? You can take them to Star Chamber. You can take them to Mr. Mom, you know? And it's still, I mean, this thing is still around, you know? I mean, I was on a plane yesterday. It's still it's playing on the flight to Frankfurt, American Airlines, if anybody hasn't seen it. And Vacation, I think what it was is it was the combination of those two. There was something similar between them. But I was already going. I wasn't really aware of what they were doing, you know.
So then how did the scripts you had done, the films that were had been made based on your scripts were not big successes then when you made the deal to do 16 Candles. How did you then get the deal to direct?
Well, I went in and I said, look, I did a rewrite on Nathan Hayes, and I worked on Class Reunion. Well, I'd written The Breakfast Club, and after this experience, I thought, well, I want to direct now. So, you know, in my sort of dumb, uninformed, you know, Chicago northern suburb, sitting in a bedroom converted to an office, thinking, okay, here's show business. I figured that if I wrote something that was real cheap, that I could like somehow scare up the money to do it, and that it would be, I would do it, it would be real easy, which is all I would have with me, five actors in one room. But it's gotta be so easy, you know, because all I have to do is deal with performance, which I like, and when I was in advertising, I did a lot of stuff, you know, I produced a lot of commercials and all that stuff, which is mainly dealing with the actors, you know. Yeah, actors and food. Movies about food are just not very good. So I had this idea to do five kids in detention. And I wrote the script, and I got involved with some Canadian dentists who had some money, and they wanted to get into the movie business. And they had only one restriction, and that was that the John Bender character be played by Jimmy Walker so that I could make a television sale. And I thought, what an odd, you know. And then they came in, I can't remember who the girl was, they had a female actress who was also, at the time, had a series or something. She was like 30, you know, and Jimmy Walker was, you know, close to 30. I'm like, so I said, no, I think we gotta leave. And I had this contract made up. It was sort of this, I can't really use the word, but it was virtually impossible for me to lose control of the work. It's like if I can't be separated from it. Of course, then I got no money for it, but the control was more important than the money at that point. And A&M Records got involved, and they said, we'll put up the money, but they wanted to put up $750,000. So in the winter of 82, I started casting in Chicago. We're going to do it in Chicago, do it all practical, do it on the cheap, non-union. And I actually had a pretty interesting cast. The people have since gone on to do, John Cusack was going to play Bender, and Virginia Madsen was going to play one of the girls. And it was interesting because it was this very, very rich class of actors at Northwestern. And while I was doing that, I wrote 16 Candles and sent it to ICM, and they sent it over to Ned Tannen, who had just left Universal to form Channel Productions, his company. He read it and said, I want to do it. What's the deal? And I said, he wants to direct it. I had no idea what I was doing. And he said, okay. Okay, now I'm sitting here with a Breakfast Club, and I've got people coming and reading, and I'm going, oh, he wants to do it. And I was faced with doing a studio picture or doing, you know, a very small production. So I said, look, I want to do the studio picture, but I don't want to lose the Breakfast Club. So I arranged for Ned to read the Breakfast Club, and Universal bought the Breakfast Club from A&M. And so, I didn't even know this was going on, but I ended up, before I'd even started, I had two back-to-back, which was great because it took a lot of pressure off of 16 Candles. You know, it wasn't like going out and doing your first one. If you fail, you'll never do this again as long as you live. Because I'd worked with a guy who is a director, and he went about 5 years without working. And I thought, what a terrible thing. I mean, if you really like to do this, and you can't work. I mean, this business is, if you want to work, it costs somebody millions of dollars. And so that privilege is really very sacred, you know. And to be able to keep doing it was, I mean, to see this guy not being able to work was pretty scary. So I had the two back to back, and I did 16 Candles that summer, and then the following winter did Breakfast Club.
That's open up to the students. Questions out there? I know there are.
Okay, beautiful.
No? There, okay.
You're 16 kids. I'm curious, the casting of the male, I enjoyed Molly Ringwald, but I didn't really enjoy the other guy, I think. You know, the one that she ended up falling for. Yeah. And I wondered if that was your choice, or is that the reason why I said this is not to downgrade you or anything. It's just that he almost seemed too good for her, meaning that, you know, she couldn't have got something like that in reality.
Well, yeah, I know what you're saying. No. That was I actually had a fight pretty hard for him because they didn't think he had enough life to him, and I didn't want a lot of life. You know, I mean, I wanted a guy who was, you know, really troubled about going out with a girl that was, you know, in that social structure was below him. And I mean, the movie was, to a certain extent, a fantasy. And I get hit a lot of time for having sentimental endings, and I do it deliberately. I mean, that movie, everything just went and came out just right. And that has a lot to do with when you're that age, you want things to come out right, you know, and they never do. Like, never. I mean, if that were done like documentary style, she'd get in the car, go home with the grandparents, they would give her more problems all day, she'd go home, have a bad time at the reception, then go to bed, and would, you know, then get up the next day and the geek would be on her again. And, you know, I choose not to. You know, at some point I depart from reality and say, okay, look, this is what I would want to feel. You know, I mean, life doesn't always come out, you know, the movies can. And I mean, there's a time and a place for that. I mean, the 70s for me, there were a couple of movies that, like, really, like Scarecrow. Did you ever see Scarecrow? And I fell in love with these two guys. God, I was sitting in the theater like this. And then all of a sudden, Al Pacino goes nuts and he's like dead. And I'm like, I mean, I felt like somebody murdered a friend of mine. And I thought, wait a minute, this is an experience that I'm not real. I don't really like this, you know. And it was Straw Dogs. Everyone saw Straw Dogs. And I came out and I said, I am never going to another movie as long as I live. You know, this movie sort of started out kind of nice. I mean, it's great. And then this woman is being raped, and these people are going in and getting acid in their face, and all these horrible things. And I thought, God, I don't want to. You know, I don't want to go through that. You know. And you know, I choose, you know, for better or for worse, not to do that. And you know, that was deliberate. It was the same thing. I got the same sort of criticism with Breakfast Club, is all they end up with a kiss. And I think what critics don't look at is that, you know, these things are written for, you know, I did this for an audience, and I took that audience's sensibilities into account. And I mean, a lot of adults think, I wonder what they did in the closet. Whereas I've yet to run across a kid who suspects anything in the closet. And they understand that the gesture of a kiss at the end is just, you know, is reconciliation, that's all, and acceptance. But does that evade your question?
You have been listening to the podcast edition of AFI On Screen, a program of the American Film Institute. For upcoming schedules, archives, and other AFI On Screen podcasts, please visit AFI.com.